I got an iPhone.
Oh, fun.
They're real good.
They are. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it's so crazy. Like, cause I didn't even hold out for so long. I was just fundamentally ignorant, and I'm not saying, oh, I didn't know how good they were. I assumed they were better. I thought they would be way more expensive. Mm. But now if you're like, yeah, I was making payments on my phone before, which was a Samsung. I don't want to throw around piece of shit, but whatever, it was fucking a Yugo in my pocket or whatever. And now I'm paying the same thing monthly, maybe longer. I don't know. Who gives a shit? And now I have an iPhone, and just, you could feel, it feels like a gun. It's got that kind of weight to it. It's like, wow. It's, yeah. And it's,
amazing. That sweatshop handiwork really, really comes through when you crack it open. But no, yeah, my mom got me an iPad mini like a few years ago, and I was so close to making the jump just after the fact, you know, like I'd just been this Android loyalist for so long. And I got that iPad, and I was like, holy shit, look at how fast I can just switch between things.
JT was like, oh, it's got all these quality of life things. And I was like, ah, oh, it's so stupid or whatever. And it's true, but because I was thinking about my cousin that died not too long ago, and I started like crying or whatever, and the iPad wiped the tears from my eyes, and I instantly knew what he was talking about. And I'm not, that wasn't like a long, shaggy dog tail to get to that. Almost a joke or whatever. It's very true. Like that, the iPhone, I was like, this is like 1,000 times better than the Android piece of shit. And what's cool, and I hate fucking Apple. Here's the thing. I think like the product is actually, I think, pretty good. And I believe all the technical stuff about why it's good. But if the marketing appeals to you, you are fucked in the head. And we all are a little bit, but I'm just like, because like that's what I didn't like about it for so long, this weird, like, it's like people that saw 2001 A Space Odyssey and didn't understand HAL is a bad guy, you know what I mean? They're just like, oh, it's white and pristine. The future is white and pristine, and all the dirty people are gone. I love it. Just the awful sort of thing, but it's a really good phone.
No, what I'll say. Yeah, no, if the kind of people that like Apple products really like HOAs and enforce their rules and stuff, you know?
Yeah.
But I, cause honestly, my wife has an iPhone. She's had one forever. And she has tried to make me feel bad for the green text bubble. Like that means anything to me. Like that means at all anything. And it's like, that actually is Apple design to be more exclusive, to like count out. Yeah,
it's so you know who the good people are,
right?
Like it's like who's gonna get to go up in the rapture, so you'll know who you're. Like, there's not really a point to make friends with this person if it's green text. We're not gonna be to when the seas begin to rise. Like they're not gonna get on the ark, so there's not really a point.
Yeah,
and you know, don't get attached.
I mean, on that flip side, though, it's like, I mean, my wife constantly can't understand why she can't play Hogwarts Legacy on her MacBook. And it's like, because they don't care about you. They don't care about what you want.
Yes. And I will say, like, it's kind of nice that it's the iPhone, because the product is so good, their entire business isn't just based on stealing your data, which is kind of nice. So I have to applaud that. But anyway, okay. I just wanted to, it has been a bit of a relation. Also, we got kittens. But
I saw some posts. Were those kittens?
Yeah. Yeah, kittens. They're like 4 or 5 months old. But this loves me more than the kittens. We got them at the same time, and I'm not saying I don't love those kittens. I really do. They're like, scritching into my heart. But this thing, if there was a fire, I'm just saying it would be a decision. And anyway, okay. So anyway, what?
Oh no,
I was holding my phone too. I said,
this thing.
I meant the phone I was holding.
Yeah, he wasn't. Yeah, he wasn't holding up one of the cats by the scruff.
A bag of
just
cats.
Just waving it around. No, I was actually gonna ask, because like I had asked before, but we never really like talked about it. But so I've gotten really into the TV show Lucifer.
And I
got into it like two seasons deep before I realized that it is loosely based off of the Gaiman spinoff from Sandman.
And you're like, you wanted to ask me as a Satan worshiper how I felt.
Oh yeah, I wanted to get get the gay man's perspective on the game and spinoff. I would have never drawn that connection had I not seen the credit finally, just in the like in the beginning thing, because there's nothing even kind of gaming about it. It's a police procedural, like the show. It's so loosely based off of like the comic book, and but there are some cool things, like, and the thing that got me like researching it was the fact that Mazikeen is in it. There, when she shows her like true demon self, she has like the half a face, and I was like, all right, that can't be a coincidence, because like Mazikeen isn't actually a biblical figure. It's like an old Hebrew word for like a specific kind of devil or whatever.
Right.
And,
sure.
Yeah, I was like, okay, so there's, and I went on this like long thing. Lucifer also pops up in the CW Flash Arrowverse crossover Infinite Crisis thing. John Constantine goes to like his club and asks him for a favor. And I was like, all right, these two shows aren't on the same network and nothing seems DC about the Lucifer show. What the fuck? And yeah, like I did all this unraveling just to find out that it is so very loosely based off of,
well,
the
and
Neil
then
Gaiman property.
I never read the Lucifer book because I could be wrong and I was steered in the wrong direction, but like, I'm pretty sure that it's not written by Neil Gaiman.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I do know, at least from what I was reading on the wiki, is that Gaiman did have direct say on like what Lucifer would look like, I guess, in the Sandman comics, and then ultimately later, which was he wanted him to look exactly like David Bowie. And
which
there
you
are
can totally see.
Yeah. And there, I will say, while the Lucifer on TV doesn't look anything like David Bowie, they play David Bowie songs in his club like all the time. So like there's these weird little nods that it's just like, hey, this is what we cared about, I guess.
The reason I didn't read it, and it's not like I'm so fundamentally against it. It just sounds like a profoundly stupid idea. But I guess maybe not even dumb. It's just like comics and comic culture are so IP fronted and not creator fronted that there's a sense, and that's its strength in certain ways. But the idea of like another writer and another creative team working on this comic or working on these characters after the originator, that's not necessarily considered a bad thing. And I totally get that. But there are these comics that feel far more like self-enclosed novels. Watchmen, Sandman, even in some ways like Alan Moore, Swamp Thing. But anyway, like the idea of somebody else writing those characters afterwards, like I just think it's obscenely stupid as an attempt. So, again, I actually read a few for a previous podcast, some of the Watchmen stuff. In and of itself, it's not poorly written, but it's like, again, I think of them more like novels. You would never do that with, like, you know, like, oh, the Brothers Karamazov, a less well-thought, a worse writer who's more mercenary working for the published company has decided to write like a spinoff of Smerdyakov. And you would just be like, of course I wouldn't buy that. And that's the thing, the market, it's partly the culture, right? Because like the publishing company, like Penguin Books would do that if anybody would read it, you know, but no one would because they respect those books and those writers in ways that doesn't translate. So anyway, my point is I would never read somebody else doing Gaiman's characters, and I don't give a shit how much Neil Gaiman is like, no, do it. My royalties, I don't care.
I agree with you, but I would also point out that Lucifer is not really a Gaiman character. You know what I mean? He happened to have been written about a few times before Gaiman came around.
You're totally right, and this is like I'm really talking about an impression I have. I don't think it's consistent or rational, and it's almost chauvinistic because it's based in the things I've read. Because you're right, if somebody's like, look, I read the Bible, okay, I don't need to read your fucking spinoff. That was written by Jesus and God. Like, I don't need your fucking, whatever. Totally fair. But anyway. Did you like it, by the way, before we get into the episode? Did you like the Lucifer series?
In the idea that I like the way the actor portrays him. He's got this weird thing he does with his eyes that really kind of sell this sort of sinister, or not sinister,
gives you,
but this
gives you a big boner. I get it.
Big boner. Mm. It filled a gap, I guess, for me in just needing a lot of something to watch.
Hot.
Yeah, yeah. his big old eyeballs filled my gaps.
I love how weirdly sexual everything you're saying is right now.
The show is weirdly sexual. All right, I wouldn't even say weirdly, but like as weird or as sexual as possible for a Fox syndicated TV show that involves like,
which is saying a lot, by the way. I do feel like.
I think so. I mean, there's a couple of. I mean, there's a one cop has a daughter who's a young girl. Like, there's a lot of like aspects of it that just feel like it should shy away from these things, but it also is very sex positive.
And then all of a sudden, it's like, here's a butthole. We're Fox. We're serious. Hey, you want to do this episode?
Yeah, yeah, let's get in it.
Comic Cannon Revival. Okay, welcome to the Comic Cannon Revival, a podcast where we look at some of the most beloved stories in the history of comics, both new and old. We take exemplary, historic, and even bizarre stories, and we put them under our figurative microscope, and we're going to do that now. Oh man, what a gush-a-thon about to happen. I don't know how you feel, but I absolutely love this comic book, and I'm a booster, generally. You know, I don't really like negative criticism generally. I think it's usually useless on it. Not. I mean, if you have something to say, if you have something like some interesting analysis that you want to do or point to make through negative criticism, but unto itself, it's like a cunty thing, right? Like somebody else makes something and you contribute nothing and like, I'm going to shit on it. Like nobody cares. But in this case, we might go too far in the other direction. I'll admit, like, because I'm about to give this comic a blowjob. So
every issue, I was like, fuck, this is great. Like at the end of every one, I was like, this is so good. I like it. It's All Red. It's this box that All Red perfectly sits in. That is
right.
Oh God. Yeah. Like, I mean, honestly, and hopefully, just being a Madman fan, like I've only know him in that context. And I was like, all right, you know, maybe I'll like the style or whatever, but just the writing, the character design,
and he means Madman the comic, not Mad Men the John Hamm,
I would,
you know, prestige television series,
right. Which I mean, you know, it's his style. Just we sucked the dick of his style so much last episode. I'm gonna really try and hold back on it, but his style just fits so well in this.
There'll be things
universe
to say about that we didn't say last time, because I think this develops his style quite a bit.
A lot.
But anyway, I will say, just in our drooling, fawning adulation of this comics, hopefully we'll point out some interesting stuff for the listener and just, you know, get into the details a little bit and in a really enjoyable way. Let's go ahead and just get the comic and the info and the housekeeping right out of the way. So we're doing Silver Surfer, A New Dawn, right? This is, I think, volume 7 of the Silver Surfer. He's one of those comic book characters that hasn't, for some reason, and I do want to talk about this, hasn't like had a kind of uninterrupted long series of comics. He's always had, like, for, or at least a while, last 20, even 30 years, sort of a bunch of miniseries, some of which are amazing. So, you know, this was issues 1 through 5. And also, I was reading from volume 1 of Silver Surfer New Dawn, like I said, Slott and All Red. And it did include an issue material from All New Marvel Now, .1, #1. So it does have like this other little dangling comic or whatever. So anyway, if we talk a little bit about that and you've read just 1 through 5 and you're like, I don't remember when this happened, that's the explanation. The first issue of this came out March 26, 2014. So that sort of puts us in there chronologically. And in some sense, I think it's very much a product of 2014. We'll get into that a bit. But let's do, just so we can get right through it, let's do the creator information. So the storytellers, that's what this, the attribution is, Dan Slott and Michael Allred. They both kind of had a lot to do with both writing and the art. So that's why they sort of, it just credits them as storytellers. Color artist was Laura Allred. The letters was VC's Clayton Cowles. Cover art by Michael Allred and Laura Allred. Assistant editor Jake Thomas and editor Tom Brevoort. I wonder if he took credit for this.
He comes up a lot.
He loves to take kind of partial credit for groundbreaking work, and then when shit is just like in the toilet, fuck bad, you don't really hear him so much. Like, I was the editor on that. I did that. That was me. But anyway.
Hey, do me a favor real quick, and I guess maybe our listeners, just in case, they're like me. What are a couple of other things that Dan Slott has written? Because I know we've talked, I know we've done episodes.
Right, so he did a great Fantastic Four run, which I think definitely check out. So Dan Slott's really good at long form storytelling. And so he has it. He's sort of like Jonathan Hickman or Jason Aaron. I have my issues with some of Jason Aaron stuff, but I mean, you have to, his ability to sort of create long form storytelling is definitely there. Dan Slott did Spider-Man. So he did the Superior Spider-Man. He's sort of known for that, which is this incredible story in a lot of ways. I mean, the story itself, right? But the story about the story, which is that like he went from being one of the most hated Spider-Man writers by the insane fan base, right, to being incredibly lauded. You have to be such a good writer to get that level of hatred, and then all those people, like, or not all of them, many of them are insane, but like a lot of them being like, ew, we should have maybe read all 12 issues.
Which actually would, like, it takes me back to the Bible, Jared, which I think we should all
Book of Leviticus, way better than you thought. No, shrimp are the devil. Anyway, so he wrote a story where Peter Parker dies and Dr. Octopus takes over.
Okay, that's what it was. Yeah, it was Superior Spider-Man. Okay.
Spider-Man, yeah. And also he did that Daredevil book we read, I think. I believe.
Oh, I thought that was...
No, that might have been Mark Waid.
Yeah, I think that was Mark Waid, though.
Yeah, they're very similar for me, and we'll talk about that too. But yeah, so Dan Slott's done a bunch of stuff. He's done a lot of like the kind of pillars of Marvel Comics. And you know, you can Google his prestigious career, but like he's worked on many, many, many characters. And I think he's more known now for his work in these big characters as opposed to sort of independent stuff.
I think, like, and I'm sure I've read a lot more Dan Slott than, like, I'm aware of. Because, Superior Spider-Man is something that, like, we have talked about on the show, and it stood out to me. But I would love this opportunity, even though it's impossible. I believe I could cherry-pick every bit of Alred out of this story. Like, that's how familiar I am with Alred's writing style. There's like little, like just the name Incredulous Zed. I was like, all right, well, that was an Alred fucking throw in. Just because he's so fucking goofy with his, just with his naming structures. And I'm sure there's some referential thing to it that I'm missing as well.
You're right, right. No, I think you're right. I noticed that too. And comic books are an inherently collaborative medium. I mean, you often have people that are sort of talented towards this kind of collaboration, which is to say you often have like writers who have a background in a graphic medium, and then you have artists who are really good at sort of and focused on narrative art. That's really common. And then, you know, in this case, I think that Dan Slott, like I listened to some interviews to try to piece together who did what. I mean, obviously the pencils are Mike Alred, that's unmistakable, but some of the character design, it seems like some of those descriptions, even at the visual level, were Dan Slott. And to your point, even more the case, a lot of this has Mike Alred's writing all over it. Not necessarily, I suppose, the scripting breakdowns. Like, I'm going to venture a guess here that like some of the more, I don't want to suggest Dan Slott's not a really interesting, really imaginative person. He absolutely is. But I think some of the more sort of structured, typical comic book writing, he's probably more responsible for, especially in that this comic has this very, not just what we read, but this larger run, which is about 29 issues, has a really complete, well-formed structure, like, you know, several parts that all fit together to make one great story. And then some of the sensibilities very much feel like, hey, Mike Alred.
Make me the happiest boy in the world and tell me that Alred was the illustrator and co-writer of all 29 of those issues.
Yeah, the whole thing is him.
Shit.
Yeah, they're great.
Oh, that's so good. I was mad. I mean, I felt shortchanged stopping at 5 because I went to the next. I was like, this is going to be like Ghost Rider, where the artist is going to change after 5, and right. I'm going to lose all interest. But then I clicked it. I was he did 6 too. Oh, yes, mm-hmm. That's so good.
Yeah, yeah, he does, and I have to like, we'll get to this probably several times, just because, you know, I'm not going to spoil anything. But not only I'm going to tell you this. Not only does this remain good, this level of quality, this interesting, and it gets more depth and character development. But also, this may be one of the best endings, like the ending that this has, that I've ever read in a comic. Which sounds strong, but anybody that's read this series is actually, oh yeah, it's. I mean, I think that if we did a kind of like online poll of Marvel comics, what comics have the best ending, this is going to get voted in like top 3. You know, and especially among people that are sort of like have a broader, you know, reading thing than just like their favorite, maybe Spider-Man or X-Men stories or whatever. But anyway, so there's a lot to like, appreciate about what's going to happen. It's not just like, oh, a good ending and they don't know where to go. Oh boy, do they know where to go. But yeah, so I guess some of this idea that like, to point specifically, the reason this feels like Elred's writing, and again, the way that they talk about it, like they did a lot of conversation, like writing the stuff out, very like among the two of them, Elred and Slott, like kind of writer's room stuff, making jokes, talk, you know, like they even said they had sound effects that they were doing. So his sense of humor is certainly in this, but specifically this world, like has this like constant tinge of like, I don't know, like silliness, sort of absurdity, irony, farce. But it's just a sort of patina. It's not, the thing isn't totally like silly Looney Tunes. You know, it just always has kind of a sense of humor on or whatever.
I will probably point this out a few times, like point out these moments that sort of like just made this a guaranteed fact for me. But Allred is a huge Doctor Who fan, and that shines through in this, especially considering who the Doctor was at this point in time. I'd wager folding money that he was a huge Matt Smith fan, because there are so many story elements of the way Matt Smith and his first companion came together and operated together in this story. And Doctor Who is full of that sort of, all right, here's some silly shit, but there's a lot of emotional depth below it that keeps you hanging on. And
Slott is a big Star Wars Next Generation fan. And I think you also see
Star Trek Next Generation.
You
said Star Wars Next Generation, and we just lost.
Well, they're actually all the same. I think they're the same.
Oh, don't do it. Don't do it. Yeah, we need these
Luke's
listeners.
Phaser and
you motherfucker.
But anyway, I think you can see some of that too. As an influence. Okay, we've talked a lot about the creators. We're going to talk especially about the art later, but let's back up and get a little bit more general. So I guess since I kind of picked this, right? I mean, I directed it towards like, one, something you'd like, and two, I picked something on the basis of what we did last episode. We're not going to get an opportunity to do that a lot, but we both love Mike Elred. Also, I wanted to do the Silver Surfer because the Silver Surfer is one of my favorite characters of all time. So I definitely wanted to eventually get to him. So it was kind of cool to do, sort of like last episode, do a Mike Elred thing. And this episode as well, go back and listen to that episode if you're interested specifically in the art, because that sort of like early Mike Elred in Madman, still very sophisticated despite how early it is in his career. And this is very mature Mike Elred. And, you know, we're going to talk about those. But anyway, so that's why I picked it. And then just to give you a brief, like, what is this story about? If you haven't read it, one, you should go read it. It's amazing. But it's kind of like Silver Surfer finds a girlfriend. I mean, you know, this is a love story in many ways. But I guess it, more pointedly, Silver Surfer, based on some cosmically bizarre circumstances, comes into contact or what have you, like, intersects the path of a girl from Cape Cod named Dawn Greenwood, kind of the perfect like pixie dream. What is the expression? Like pixie dream girl.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. That's what makes us feel very 2014. Like If this was cast at the time, it was like Zoe Deschanel or whatever would definitely have been cast.
No, yeah, she's definitely got mad like Ramona Flowers vibes.
Yes, definitely. So this is like about their sort of star-crossed lovers. Like that's not really what the phrase means, but anyway, yeah. So they're sort of like
super literal in throughout this the context. No, yeah, like exactly. This is. I bet they started with that.
Somebody in the in the creation had to have said that, had to have put that expression together. So yeah, and what I want to do before we get further into both the sort of creators and this comic and the details and the art and stuff like that, I want to talk about the Silver Surfer generally. Because as I said, Silver Surfer is one of my favorite characters of all time, and I have so much to say. I'm going to try to like narrow my focus a little bit. But why don't you give me a sense of like what you were, you can not like him if you want, what were your impressions about Silver Surfer? What do you think about him generally? What were your first experiences? That kind of stuff.
No, I'm actually going to give you, I think, what you need, what your heart needs, Jared, and let you know that I am incredibly unfamiliar with Norman.
Oh, good. Okay.
The Silver, I like that. The Silver Surfer. Like I would say my understanding comes more from, him making cameos and things that not great late 90s animated show on Fox.
I do like that in a way, just because I find it's very, the tone is very like, not just Silver Surfer, but the show's tone is very sort of stoic and solemn, and it feels a bit alien. I don't love that show, but I do think that there are interesting things about it or whatever. But anyway.
And I mean, I think my most exposure was reading his appearances in like Guardians of the Galaxy comics and things like that. Like he would kind of zip in and out of their lives and more. And he always just came off as an enigmatic, kind of stoic. Not really getting an opportunity to really showcase his personality at all in these very short vignettes. So very limited. That being said, I think that was perfect for this, or for the way I was able to take this in, because it's so much more human. It's so much more grounded. He is a much more grounded character than I was aware of. That's really all I have to say. So you please tell me why you love Silver Surfer so much.
Well, let's start at the story, which just so you have a say, if this is all you've read, and by the way, there's probably plenty of people out there because of how critically acclaimed this story was that have only read this, or have, when they think of the Silver Surfer, they mostly think of this, and that's not bad. This is atypical Silver Surfer comicdom, I guess, but the character, I think, is well preserved, and there's a sense where, like, let's say post MCU, where the popularity of those versions of the characters began to kind of eat into or even overwrite the comic book character, like in the comics. So let's think of Iron Man or Thor, really good example where they really started to, they were based more on how the actor and the evolution of those movies, sort of how they were portrayed. And even when that's, I think, dramatic departures from those characters, that's the Tony Stark we have now in the comics is Robert Downey Jr., right? In this case, that's not how it is. Like this Silver Surfer very much resonates with how Silver Surfer always was. It's just the tone of the comic is different, the vantage point, the perspective, but I think it still preserves that. So even though, I guess my point is, even though you haven't read reading this isn't like a lot of other Silver Surfer comics, you do get to know this character really well in this book. But sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that's an interesting point to make, because Marvel now, in at this point in the publication history, was an effort to sort of unify the MCU with the comic book world. I think I felt like it was this trying to meet these two media in the middle, and I think it's interesting that Silver Surfer got any spotlight, considering that at the time Fantastic Four was not owned by Marvel Studios, like the rights, was owned by Fox, and for them to, I mean, because let's call a spade here. Marvel played dirty pool real hard with the Fantastic Four and the X-Men in the comics to try and leverage those properties back into their own like cinematic rights. So,
right.
For them to give Silver Surfer a little spotlight before the Fox merger, I think it's still, you know, it's a great choice.
I don't know that I agree. I don't know the editorial history so well. So this could be as easy as the creators pushed for this, you know, that they sure. really wanted the, you know, I mean, Mike Allred is a pretty cherished property in many ways. And, you know, I mean, he's got the kind of clout, or at least it appears from my vantage point, right? That he can kind of, you know, pitch, like, I want to work on this character. And I think, you know, editors are going to be pretty interested in that in ways that, you know, other writers are often sort of like, the way that they get to work is by being, you know, kind of more journeyman and like, you know, we need somebody to write the X-Men here. Can you, or this spinoff book or something like that. Anyway. Right. So yeah. Man, I like, where do I want to begin? Okay. What I try to focus on is like, if a character is old and they're still being written and they have a fan base and you don't like them, you're probably wrong. I mean, or at least like you're relatively ignorant as to like their fan base has a reason to like them. Right. And I've always loved Silver Surfer comics, but I think that the image that really stuck with me, this sort of like poetic concept that when it really struck, I was like, oh, this character's so, I mean, it's just unique and interesting, is that you have this dude in, you think about the infinite, quiet, dark expanse of the cosmos, nothing but blackness and starlight. And in the center of that, in the universe, everywhere is the center, but you know what I mean? Like in the middle of that sea of darkness, you have this metallic skinned character reflecting back that infinite expanse, the star, and just the visual, I think, is in intense. And it describes something that I think is so so connected to its time and its creators. You know, this is a Silver Surfer was created by Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, and it's a perfect merger of them and the time, because you have the sort of like god of the cosmos, sort of like neo mythology that Kirby was all about, and then that sort of 60s kitsch and like pop writing that Stan Lee perfected. And what a cool merger of the two. And I want to, before the last thing I want to sort of mention, and I bring up Thor probably not just too much on this podcast, but too much in my life, and but because I love that character so much, I have a tendency to sort of see a lot of comics through that character. But there's an interesting comparison here, right? Because there's a way where, if you understand the concept a little bit, it's sort of thematically lush. It has such potential, because the idea of Thor is that he is both the son of a sky father and the son of the earth goddess. And he's, you know, lightning is one of his symbols. And so he is literally exactly the point where the ground meets the sky. And, you know, there's so much you can do with that. And so writers that have a tendency to just see him as a big guy with a hammer, they might be technically skilled, but it reflects a profound two-dimensional imagination. Okay, so backing up, very similar with the Silver Surfer. The concept alone about this, it's like how, you know, kind of Greek mythology where we project ourselves into the stars. This is a sort of like 60s, very optimistic version of that, where, you know, the Silver Surfer is not just like he is powered by the power cosmic, but he comes from this very grounded earth-like place of Zen La, and he reaches his ambitions were, you know, he lived in this kind of like, kind of, I guess, futuristic, but all still quotidian kind of society, right? Very parochial. And he looks out and wants more. And his attitude is also a combination of those two. He is both very human, but also very, like, you know, cosmically aware. And it's such a, I think, ambitious in joining of both the human and the sort of, you know, transcendent beyond human or whatever. And he blasts stuff with his hands.
I was about to say, up until that point, I would only have to change a few, just a few like nouns and adjectives in there to make that a Doctor Who synopsis, which is like,
no, absolutely.
You know what I mean? I think are like really meeting in the middle here is,
right.
I mean, because again, it's like, that really is fairly unheard of. I mean, that's unheard of on TV, is to have a character created in the 60s being like still written today and and played on television, you know? Like, it's all like Star right. Trek, Star Wars, you got to shift, you got to change the characters you're focusing on. But this brilliant concept of regeneration that, you know, they had to come up with after the first Doctor got sick two seasons in, you know, it will keep the, it'll, you know, it's evergreen. And kind of what you said about how, like, a character that started off this way is going to be written poorly over and over again. Totally true for the Doctor. Like,
oh,
I,
right.
I,
yeah, yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
the Doctor, there are several Doctors that are, you know, universally loved or universally hated. And it just kind of goes right. back and forth. And you always just get to wash, rinse, and repeat and try again. And
But there's something nice about that kind of pulp writing that you see in comics and which is that, like, you know, yes, you do have a lot of, I don't even want to say low quality. It's again, just like sort of pulpier writing, but that the concept in both cases is very sort of interesting and robust and profound. And there's something really cool about it, even when it's being sort of very, you know, not poorly written. Again, I don't want to exaggerate it, but just, you know, it has a kind of like two-dimensional sort of feeling. It still has this sort of relatively profound concept in the background. Yeah. And then the other thing that I want to mention about the Silver Surfer generally, which is unique, I think, or if not unique, at least it very different than what you would expect, I guess, from a character, especially of his power level. You know, Silver Surfer is like, you know, the sort of three major powerhouses in the Marvel stable are the Hulk, Thor, and Silver Surfer. There are others and different kinds of characters. I think in some sense they're the most powerful characters that are still characters. You have all of these things like the Scarlet Witch or Jean Grey or Franklin Richards, but these aren't characters. Like, I mean, it's a nice belief. Like, you know, they at some prima facie level, they're characters, but their powers are just like the writer now just can make a thing happen. They're a way that the writer gets to just not have any limitations or discipline or whatever. So anyway, so you have those sort of like really powerful characters like that Superman kind of level. But, you know, Thor is a Viking god. The Hulk is like this punchy rage machine. Silver Surfer is like he's not a pacifist, that would be wrong, but he's like a type B personality. He's a contemplative philosopher. He has no interest in like fighting. He's a scientist. I mean, at least, you know, in his original, he's an astronomer in his original discipline.
Take that with compared. Yeah. Okay. Again, like again, all Doctor Who stuff. Also, he rides around right. on a commonly terrestrial object through space.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like Doctor Who rides around in a phone booth. He rides around on a surfboard without anything to surf on.
Yeah, yeah. But there are differences, and I think, and there are obviously going to be differences, but I think some of, and this is another thing about the Surfer's sort of Norrin Rad, his character, is that I don't know much about Doctor Who, but my sense, and a lot of times, is there's a kind of like pithy aloofness and that Doctor Who has. I'll tell you, that if you read that in this, that has more to do with this instantiation. Silver Surfer is usually far more, not just stoic, and in this comic, as it goes along, you get more of this. Silver Surfer is guilt-ridden, and that's very interesting, and that's a very different kind of, not than Doctor Who initially, but you know, he has a sort of sorrow that's always attached to him. He's probably most similar to Martian Manhunter, if you're a big DC fan, if you have a sense of that. Very powerful, can do almost anything. But, you know, rather than being like an aggressive warrior god, as a matter of Martian Manhunter, you know, he has to be like pacifistic so he doesn't, you know, upset Superman fans. I don't know. You know what I mean? Like, well, he wouldn't fight as well because he's a pussy. I don't, anyway. But so Silver Surfer, if you don't have a sense of his origin, the idea is that the Galactus, this planet eating, multi-powerful cosmic being, came to Zenla, his original, the planet that Silver Surfer is from, and was going to, it was going to eat it.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Norrin Rand said, no, if you don't eat, destroy the planet, I'll work for you. I guess, you know, the labor market was tight in the universe, and so Galactus, that was very important. But so for, you know, and it depends on how you read it, maybe millennia, who knows, he is the herald of Galactus, and he goes around working for Galactus, where he's like kind of like a surveyor, essentially. He finds planets that would be susceptible for Galactus to dine upon. And question.
Just for us new Silver Surfer fans, was he the first herald of Galactus?
No, he was. It was obviously in the comics the first one, right?
Right.
No, there have been some. I think there's at least two. There's the Fallen One, who is a really badass looking character. He's like kind of like looks like they were trying to describe dark matter. His long flowing hair and everything like that. And I think that the character Tyrant may have been an original herald too. Okay. I can't remember. He was related in some way, but the Fallen One's the first one. Silver Surfer in the comics often is sort of described as like his best herald or his maybe the longest running herald or something like that. But, you know, and then the first story in the Fantastic Four in the 60s, which is, you know, ironically, you know, the introduction for us of the Silver Surfer is him rebelling against his master Galactus, and because he falls in love with humans because we're so great, and he has to, you know, and then he and the Fantastic Four obviously stop Galactus from eating the Earth, but to punish Silver Surfer, he is trapped on the Earth. Like, there's a force field that Galactus places over, and so he can't leave. So ironically, the Starman is not allowed to leave Earth.
Okay, so the third Doctor, Jonathan Pertwee, who worked for also the trapped. Time Lords, was trapped on Earth. His TARDIS was disabled, and he worked for the British government and did all of his stories terrestrially.
I mean, you've convinced me. They're very similar.
No, I just want you to watch Doctor Who. I'm trying to sell you all of these elements you love happen to be exist in a schlocky British soap opera that has gotten more and more money and has become more and more well-written and well-executed, I think.
Right. I'll check it out. I mean, I even love, British. I'm a bit of an Anglophile, but it just never. And I've watched some episodes. Like, I've seen the Angels, the ones. But anyway, okay. So let's talk a little bit more about the details here. Let's talk about the art. It would be easy to kind of blow past it because we already talked about Allred, and you know, I've mentioned this many times on podcasts that art has a tendency to be less emphasized because in a lot of ways it's harder to talk about, and then a lot of the ways people talk about it, they're just like, it's great, I love it, and it doesn't really get the spotlight it deserves. But we talked about Allred before, so that was early Allred, that was Mad Men Allred in our previous episode. This is, I dare say, a very advanced, very like the final form of Allred or whatever. Do you find these very distinct, very different? How do you feel about this art?
Okay, so I was going to point out that when you were describing or comparing him to Mignola, I think in the last episode, we have done an episode that on an early Mignola artwork with Doctor Strange and Doctor Doom, and then a later a more evolved version of his artwork in a Hellboy comic, and I gotta say, like, I think Allred starts off so strong and so, like, on top, like, already knowing what his style is. And these two things are not entirely comparable. Like, they're not one-to-one connections because Mignola didn't start independent as much as he, like, got some ground working for Marvel and the bigger labels, whereas, like, Mike Allred came out swinging on his, just printing his own shit and stuff. But that is to say that this is amazing and so polished that every second of it is just every panel just feels so good, but there's so much of it that was there in the beginning too, it's great to see someone, and I Alex Ross or somebody, who just finds this style so early on and does nothing but polish it and does not make any conceits to change it for whatever, to change it to match something that you think it's supposed to, or maybe he just waits for these projects that are perfect for his style,
With Alex Ross, by the way, there's a sense where for whatever reason, they decided to talk to get a figurative art, like a classic sort of oil painter. Because in some sense, I love Alex Ross, and I think he's a great artist or for what he does. But like in certain ways, it's like it feels like any painter could do what he does. It's just like for whatever reason, they finally like maybe we should get a painter. Would a painter do this or whatever? And again, taking nothing away from it, and he has his own interesting style. But I guess what I'm saying is that like in a lot of ways, like you know, it just it's weird. It would be like we're doing some comics, we're gonna sculpt him this time. I'm just gonna sculptor to do it.
I mean, to that point, to ask a painter to commit that much time and effort to what I, you know, serious artists are gonna consider like frivolous top like subject matter. I'm just glad we got one of those in the corner. Absolutely. You know what I mean?
And the comparison to Mignola is interesting on a few levels. I think the comparison I made to him before was more about just that they have very interesting, you know, off the beaten path kinds of comic careers that they've both, there are a lot of similarities, I guess. I mean, because they've both worked in, you know, conventional, and I put that in quotation, sort of, you know, standard, you know, big like Marvel or DC comics. And then they've also done, you know, incredibly independent stuff. They also visually, they're not very similar in the way they styles, but they are so signature, those styles. You instantly know their styles. And I will say, I think that the difference and the reason Madman, I think, had to be published sort of like independently because the art in Madman is good. I like it, but I don't think you can sell it alone on that art. You know,
sure. Sure. Yeah.
This Al Red, the art is so distinct and interesting. If he had this style, I think he could just be a highly rated top, you know, of the industry kind of artist. But at the time, not so much. So his art has interestingly become, I think, gotten, as you said, like more polished, more refined, as opposed to guys like Frank Miller or Mignola, where in a weird way, their art got not worse, but like, I think as they went, maybe even a little less detailed, like they distilled things down to very simple, like shapes and in ways that I think, you know, Allred's moved in the opposite direction.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, just the design of that planet. What is it called? Inception? Incepticon? The planet in the beginning.
What is it called? It's like the Imaginarium or something like that.
Right.
Let's just look.
It's got this real...
The Impericon.
It's got this real Ethereum planet of 1,000 cities, whatever, right. You know, like whatever comic that was based off. It's so many just buildings. It's a planet that is so big and just full of hotels and it's a resort and everything. But like if you zoom in, if you'd like just get in there and like really look at it, every building has its own distinct lines, shape. Like he didn't draw this muddled ball of lines just to kind of give you the impression of a complicated planet. You can get in there and see windows on each one of these fucking things, and they all kind of angle out in this weird way that denotes how tall they are, depending on like the curvature of how this planet can operate and everything. It's insane. And I mean, even the cosmic horror stuff that kind of comes later, you just zoom in and it's like there's veins on all these tentacles that are wrapping around the Hulk and Doctor Strange, and it's so detailed. And his wife Laura does such a good job of keeping up with that level.
She did the colors. I think he may have done some too. No, you're right. I mean, she's not going to get as much credit as she really ought to. I think her work on this is something I really love, and not. I mean, it's vivid and beautiful, like a lot of color work in comics, but the depth it creates in his work here is something I really love.
Mm-hmm.
Because my thought was that, you know, I've always associated him with like a guy that took the, you know, kind of pop art sensibilities and, you know, threw them into the comic book medium. In this feels like pop art, but really fully formed and three-dimensional. Which is not something you think about with pop art. And I love that about this. Incidentally, I was like, man, this would be the... If they did this comic... And you know they won't. They won't make this movie.
Right.
But if they did, it would be like the Into the Spider-Verse. It would be a massive hit if they found a way to use that kind of animation and affect this style in that three-dimensional way. I think it would be absolutely brilliant.
Which is it, and okay, so you can also we you'd mentioned Jack Kirby earlier. I feel like
they're very similar.
The reason similar. This works so well with this character is because I think All Red's style harkens back to such a Kirby-esque timeline. But it's also crazy that the amount of detail that we just discussed and how beautifully Mike Allred can bring that across with such a nondescript character being in the center of it. You know, like there's actually not a lot of detail to the Silver Surfer. He is a white amorphous man with black eyes.
I would say the detail comes from, again, sort of more the color. Like they have really interesting shading and depth.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. You can always see his musculature and everything. And then like when he drops the silver stuff, like the eyes have all this crazy, you know, like really strong detail in his pupils and everything. Mm. But I love him in the center of this wildly colored world with all these other things. And he is just he is just this very, I mean,
he's minimalistic. And you mentioned the eyes. I actually think it's a brilliant choice. I think it changes him up quite nicely from a lot of earlier depictions. Because in many ways, you know, this is just Mike Allred's art, and he did the Silver Surfer. Like, he depicts the Silver Surfer. But there are some really, I think, interesting and clever design choices. The eyes are one. And I love how they're sort of, they have the there's no pupil, you know, it's just white. But the shape, it's almost like drag queen makeup.
Yep.
And it really does kind of like the cool, like Silver Surfer dialectic between very expressive and very vacant.
I mean, yeah, it's like when you look at like that Madman trade paperback that we got, it's, I mean, his original design with the full white head and everything without the hair sticking out, it's almost like Allred was waiting for this moment. You know what I mean?
And I love his Norrin Rad outside, like when he is silver down, because it's like now he has pupils and he's very intense eyes. He looks like young Patrick Stewart. It's awesome.
Very much so. Oh yeah. That's a great comparison. Yeah.
Incidentally, if for the reader, I don't think we need to touch on it that much. That's not something that Silver Surfer classically does or can do. I can't say in his entire history before this, he's never silvered down. And he's certainly been many cases where he's turned, he's been depowered or whatever. But usually it's not a thing where he just like has almost like Colossus powers where he silvers up and down. I think it was a brilliant idea here.
Agreed.
You know, for many reasons, but you know, I think it's such a wonderful reminder too that like Silver Surfer is a character under there. Like, he's just a dude from Xinla under that. And he's been irrevocably changed based on his cosmic experiences, but that core still exists, which you got to do if you're going to do this, like, love story. Mm-hmm. And, oh, man, what a love story. Is there anything else you wanted to say about the art?
I'll probably... It's gonna shoot out of me sporadically as we go, as we talk about certain moments in the story, because, again, there's just... I would just sit there and... It actually took, I mean, 5 issues is not hard to digest, especially in, you know, this like 25 page format or whatever each one of these was. I would just sit there and just take it in, just soak in separate panels. So like, I think for the sake of brevity, I think we can move on to the story. Well, and
I want to say, this will be a good bridge because I think one, you know, again, it's a collaborative art form, and you know, I don't think that Slott and Allred are necessarily going to go down as a Lee Kirby combo in perhaps a way they ought to, because they're both in the story showing this incredible range and really I think this attention to very true detail at both sides of you know, the small and the large, the sort of like, again, the very, very pedestrian and the cosmic in ways that feels very familiar. Now, I'm not saying that they are aliens or whatever, but so to the art, I think what's really interesting is how well, and I don't think I would have known this, but Mike Allred's style is really good at doing, you know, sort of conventional character-based corporeal terrestrial stories, like in the, because there's a couple here. I mean, one just when we open and we're showing Dawn's life, and then also the flashback with Nightmare. Mm-hmm. It's really good. It's very grounded. It feels very real. I get really lost in it. And then obviously his, when he wants to do this stuff that's like surreal and, you know, psychedelic and hypnotic, obvious. He not only is amazing at this panoply of colors, but the crazy ass designs, like it's hard, like the weird choices he makes, like with Incredulous Zed, where he has the throat.
Yeah, mouth, it's almost like J-Fod Beeblebrox's kind of.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's just, he has a vivid imagination. The fact that he can do both. And I think the same thing goes for Dan Slott's writing. And again, they're both writers probably on this, but like this idea of doing these really, really grounded, realistic, familiar sort of relationship conversations and very rich character motivations. And then, and I have to say this from my perspective, from a guy who studied philosophy, which, you know, is dumb, but the familiarity Slott and Allred seem to have with philosophical concepts, not just like terminology or use of language or something like that, but seeming to sort of understand maybe like what's at stake or the sort of texture of these sort of conversations, like that they have a good idea. Like I'll get to it when we talk about it, but I think the Queen of Nevers, is that her name? Did I get that right?
Yeah.
The concept, it really is almost out of Aristotle. And later on, it gets even more interesting and at the frontiers of sort of like cosmology and philosophy. So the fact that the writing and the art are both so good at both ends of that spectrum is what I think absolutely, like the core of what works about this comic book.
Absolutely. And I was actually going to say that because there's... When it gets on that macro scale and it shows like the Queen of Nevers and the known universe outside of moments, having these things, that was where like I was like, oh yeah, this is Kirby as shit. And it also, you know, it also is the lack of detail that makes it beautiful in a certain way, like the way that they sort of represent, like he is this void with stars and planets inside of him, and she is this sort of vague. Like her body is made up of these kind of nebulous sort of spaces and things like that. And Mike Allred being able to also get that, like that style across without having to, you know, the idea that he's so versatile in a contrast sort of way, in a way that is like, I can show every lobe on a brain, which is another fucking Freakazoid thing I want to get to, Mr. Migdala. There's a bad guy in Freakazoid called the Lobe. Anyways, like I feel like he's almost mocking it now. Like Allred's doing fine, and he's kind of shining a mirror back. But anyways, like the fact that you brought up Frank Miller before, I just wanted to spit because like I like Frank Miller's style, but like you're right, it is like he kind of was drinking his own Kool-Aid and has just gotten into this like just cave painting kind of nondescript bullshit nowadays. Sorry Frank, in case I know you're probably not busy right now, so you're listening to our podcast, but it's Mike Allred is getting this opportunity to showcase his skills in a way that he deserved from the get-go, and I'm so glad he has it. And it makes me feel like I'm reading an old comic without any of that, you know, without the yellowed pages, without the, you know, without the like curled lack of definition that, you know, that had to come with those, that, you know, the time. And no, yeah, I'm gonna swallow the next 24 issues in the next like 48 hours.
Oh yeah, you'll love it, and you'll get right through it too. It's not that big a run, but I will say too, to maybe illustrate one of the points we've been sort of making here. People are probably less familiar with the Silver Surfer, just sort of statistically, but like it's very similar to Superman, in a way, like, you know, you can kind of get away, if you're a writer or an artist, with just doing the Superman World of Tomorrow kind of thing. But the greatest Superman comics, not, visually as well as in the writing, are the ones that really understand how to depict the balance between Clark and Kal-El. Like, in other words, really good at doing the Daily Bugle and Smallville Farm, and also really great at doing Krypton and Superman flying faster than the speed of bullet and, like, you know, lifting a destroyer or whatever.
Yeah. So
very similar here. There's a Norin, there's a surfer, and you have to be able to do both really well, and they do. So before we kind of get more into the details of the story, let's talk about Dawn a little bit. This is a Silver Surfer comic. It would be sort of easy to gloss over her a bit. I mean, just in terms of describing her, but she really is not only essential to the story, but this is sort of a Dawn Greenwood story as well. This is really a totally accurate title would be Silver Surfer and Dawn, or Norin and Dawn.
Yeah.
So what was your sense of her? Like, did you like the character? Do you feel like she's interesting, generic? What do you like about her? That kind
of
stuff.
I'm one of those assholes that kind of always sees himself in what he's reading, or tries to find some, you know, tries to place himself in a story to get more engulfed in it. And I actually feel like I am more like the other twin, who is the person who wanted to, like, go out and see everything. And,
right.
Like, my younger brother would be the person who was like, you know, I'm good here. Or, like, the rest of my family is honestly sort of that. You know, like, this works. I love this. This is a beautiful place. And I used to, like, I don't know, look down on that, I guess, maybe. But the longer I've been away from home, the more I think, you know, like, yeah. Hey, maybe they had the right idea. So, like, I'm really endeared to her just valuing what she has and being able to. And I think it's really good to pair that up with someone who is so well traveled as Norin. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. In the broadest sense. And I think they play off of each other very well. And he's always like delightfully charmed by her. He's always just like, oh, okay, all right, yeah. Oh, you know, that's cute. And it's very Doctor Who, like, the best doctor companion relationships are always those sort of things where she's quick, she's clever, she's really ready to accept change and shift in environment, but at the same time, she would have been totally happy just being at home with her dad, helping him run this Airbnb, which is just right. So sweet and saccharine, you know?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think she's a really well-written, really well-conceived, maybe more character, because there is a sense where she's this, you know, you might write this in a more tropey way where she is stuck at home and really wants to leave, but she's afraid, and then, you know, Surfer is, you know, trying to get to a more grounded place and trying to find a home. But that's not really what they do. You have a sort of similar dynamic, but the idea, as you say, is that she really loves her home, and she has a twin. And the twin is, as you say, like, always trying to leave and see the world, and she sees no reason to leave because she loves her home so much. And I think that's really interesting because, like, it's almost, you get the sense that she sees the world in a very different way. She's a very, like, just off the beaten path, out of the box kind of thinker. And so she's almost getting something out of the world that she's her hometown in a way others people are sort of incapable of, you know? So it's almost like, her sister has a more literalist sort of approach to, like, adventure and things like that. It's like, there was something that reminded me, it's like how they talk about biodiversity and how it's actually a misconception that, like, any square, you know, part of your yard has as much biodiversity as the Amazon rainforest, just because, you know, of the all kinds of, away from just microorganisms, just sort of like things beneath our notice or whatever. And that sort of, it seems to be the character that she is. And I like the idea of, like, it's that she's so satisfied that the trial for her isn't escaping her home, it's leaving her home. You know, yeah. Like she, to maybe find herself a little bit more, she's got to leave to grow out of it, you know?
I mean, it was something that I was having a hard time putting my finger on until they, like, the writers do a good job of just going ahead and helping you find that spot, which is that she's like Dorothy, you know? It's like, the you know, like Dorothy yeah. and the Wizard of Oz is this real small town Kansas girl, but the second she's flung into this crazy new place, like, she doesn't really lose a beat by moving forward, you know? Like, at no point right. is she ever just, like, completely lost in direction or, like, what she needs to accomplish, you know? She just, she's not home. She would like to get home, and she yeah. will do what she has to do logically, step by step, to do that. And
right.
doesn't make any of these new characters feel out of place or odd. She's very accepting of everything. And yeah, it's heartwarming.
And she's a real, I don't want to sound like, you know, one of those anti-woke annoying people or whatever. But she's also, she has a certain integrity, and she feels like a real person in a way that characters, who are, you know, especially like, writers who are trying to be more progressive will write women often as like, they're just heroes by virtue of being a woman, which might be a valid political perspective, but it's not how you write a person. Mm-hmm. People aren't that yeah. way. Anybody that's read the Captain Marvel, or sorry, seen the Captain Marvel movie, sort of a good example of the opposite of what I'm talking about, where it's like, it's not, there's nothing wrong with the sort of basic, however banal, political values of that movie, but the character has no journey. The character is basically so great, and the only thing she needs to know is how great she is. You know, I'm so, like, I'm too nice. Anyway, so I thought this was a far more three-dimensional character, and it's a guy, it's a man writing a woman and everything like that. And again, it does kind of go into the pixie dream girl tropes a bit, but in almost defense of that, and I say this as a gay man, so partially objective here, like, there is something about the pixie dream girl. It's like, well, you are basically kind of saying that this is, rather than purely, you know, beautiful or purely like, you know, there to make the man feel better about themselves, you are sort of applauding her for her taste and integrity and intelligence and style and stuff like that. So it's a, I think if you're going to have a kind of like trope that a woman's going to fall into, this is a more respectful one, a more kind of like a less chauvinistic one. So
yeah. I mean, like, a quirky girl is always going to work for, you know, a comic book reader. You know what I mean? Like, just some, right. something that is, right. She's not a damsel. She's not Mary Sue.
For a nerd, quirky is achievable.
right. While quirky can have its pitfalls as far as, like, the way human beings operate. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, like, I feel like Scott Pilgrim kind of explores that a little bit more than some, you know, than some stories. Because, you know, it's like that.
Right.
That can denote flakiness or lack of commitment to things, whatever. You know, I'm not. We've all had our run-ins with performers, or yeah. you know, people that, you know, like,
and
like,
and a, that goes in. That goes into, like, there are things that are interesting in movies, or books or whatever, character traits, but that would be, or appalling to be around in a real person.
Yeah. If you ever dated a dancer. Or yeah. you know, like an actress, like it's that quirk. The shine comes off the apple on the quirk a little bit sometimes, and you just realize that sometimes sure. you wouldn't hate somebody who just values what they have and are cool yeah. with appreciating the things that are already there, as opposed to thinking about everything that they don't have and being obsessed with obtaining that.
To underscore that quirkiness a little bit, there is a sense, and I thought this was subtle, that like. Silver Surfer meets her, and this isn't like Silver Surfer in his origin, where he's seeing Alicia Masters, so he's seeing the goodness of humanity for the first time. This Silver Surfer actually knows a lot about Earth.
Right.
Like, that's what's interesting about it, is like, she sort of says something maybe a little cheeky, and he's like, no, I've seen the Wizard of Oz. I used to live on Earth. I've seen all of it. Like, I know everything. And that feeds back into his appreciation for her, is that, you know, and this sense of her character being unique, even from his vantage point, he thinks she's interesting, not because he's never seen a human before. He thinks she's interesting because he's seen basically all of humanity, and she stands out in this unique little sort of way, you know. And the idea of the Silver Surfer is, you know, he can see the greatest, you know, cosmic structure of the universe, and he can see down to the most infinitesimal sort of event, and he still thinks Dawn is special. So it's, yeah, I think it's fantastic. Yeah.
I let me ask you this, because this is something that I kind of noticed from the get-go is, and her dad calls her Ladybug, but I wonder if there's something to the fact that she kind of dresses like a ladybug and her sister dresses like a bumblebee. I wonder if there's anything like to that, like, you know,
I'm not sure. It would almost have to be, right? I mean, right, like, I know ladybugs are good luck. And, you know, maybe there's more to it. I don't know.
Or and like, I don't know. Just maybe the amount of freedom involved with those two, like the two concepts of those two insects. You know, it's like one isn't doing what they think they're supposed to do. Like a ladybug isn't a swarm insect or like a hive mind sort of thing, and a bumblebee,
right,
you know, is always kind of, you know, is going out, but like is ultimately doing what all the other bumblebees are doing. You know what I mean?
Sure.
This is onion layers I'm trying to peel right now while we're talking.
I almost don't want to say too much because later on the series he is going to get into this a little bit, and I don't want to give it away totally. But no, it's a good catch, and obviously it's a very peculiar choice. So yeah, I think you're right. It's not just incidental that they pick these two. You know, have them dress like, you know. It's also funny that like it's an artifact of comics where this is supposed to be just a normal person, but they're going to wear the same dress forever
or all the time. Yeah. Doctor Who companions do that too. Like they, you know, right. Which almost makes sense in the idea that like they were whisked away on a spaceship and left all of their shit behind. So like,
right.
Really they got a couple of things, but I like also that her twin is not a black and white character either. Like she is not like her twin almost kind of seems like an asshole, and it would be easy to just be like, well, obviously Dawn was the good one, but right. Like they love each other. They have a really good relationship. They both love their father. It just wouldn't be right for her twin to live the life that she lives. And they, you know, they differ in this one way, but they get along. They get along and they have a healthy relationship, which is really good to see as well. Cause it would be super easy to make her twin just a cut and dry asshole.
And well, yeah, no, that's true. I mean, like, there's a lot of these characters are in some ways participating or plays on tropes without while still being sort of more than those tropes and being more realistic. And I'll say also, just from the kind of writing mechanics here, that there's something very smart about doing this, because it's a very on its face peculiar decision that I think a lot of people wouldn't do on the more the physical basis of it. Like, so you're gonna have a Silver Surfer comic where he gets a girlfriend who's ostensibly a normal Earth girl and just flies around the universe. That's a hard thing to pitch unless you're, you know, Dan Slott and Mike Outred, I think. And I just think that's such a weird, awesome thing that they did. It isn't a take that I think you would predict. The fanship certainly wouldn't be like, this is what we need. But again, from the writing mechanic standpoint, it solves a lot of problems. You know, I mean, Silver Surfer is, I think, fundamentally, usually out in the cosmos in space alone. And so giving him like a person with like dialogue, like they've done this before where they give, there's a certain device they'll have, he'll have some sort of companion, and the companion's often like some plucky character like Pip the Troll or maybe the Impossible Man or something like that, or vice versa. He'll have like a kind of, you know, spacefaring girlfriend like Nova or something else. And you can feel a little bit that this is usually because so they'll have some sort of conversation. Otherwise, Silver Surfer will go down to, you know, a planet and interact with a local or something like that. It is something really cool about like, okay, we're going to have that sort of device kind of character. We're going to have this person so we can have dialogue so we can understand our character, do characterization, everything like that, but they're going to actually have a real relationship that is going to have stakes, and we're going to develop over the course of the thing, and it's a romantic relationship. And I think we forget in writing, like, not only are romantic relationships real, like that's what people have, it's very important to us, from a writing standpoint it's also like it creates a lot of like direction. Like, yeah. It gives our, one, obviously stakes, because this is a person that our character cares about a lot, but also it's sort of like, okay, why is he doing anything? Why is he going, well, he's going there because he's got to get her back or whatever. You know?
Well, and Absolutely. And I think, like, I'm holding a sonic screwdriver while I say this, but that is the point of the companion in the Doctor Who series, is they act as the viewer. So, like, you know, he is always, like the Watson to Sherlock, you know, it's like, he is this genius that knows everything about the universe and has seen everything and has been everywhere. Mm-hmm. But somebody needs to ask him how he knows something, or, you know, like, why this works this way. And if it's another galaxy traveling person or someone who's that familiar, it doesn't make sense for them to ask these very common sense questions that we need to know so that we can be interested in what he's doing. And this is a really, I mean, she doesn't ask stupid questions either. Like, there's a lot of it.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things that happen. She was like, yeah, okay, that's fine. Magic, you know, or whatever. Or, you know, okay, yeah, this alien burps acid if you give him apples, you know, and like, she acclimates to things in a way that we would, as, you know, readers of comics, and understand that this kind of shit just has to happen. But like, then there are things that need to be asked and pointed out. And someone who's so grounded like Dawn is a perfect vehicle to do that without getting way exposition ridden, you know, or like,
the writer's got to world build, which means the writer's got to do a lot of exposition some way or another. They've got to tell us about the world. And you're right. Putting Dawn in there is this way where she's just going to have natural questions. She's going to be inquisitive about her situation, and we get to learn through all that. And like I said, the Surfer is a nigh immortal being. You know, I mean, he can technically probably be killed, especially by, but you know, the idea is like, you know, you're not too worried about Silver Surfer physically most of the time. And if you're, his comics in the past have often surrounded, the stakes are more about moral conundrums than they are about his bodily, you know,
like
his
a good death Superman or story, like you said.
Yeah, exactly. Except I would say Silver Surfer is maybe a worse problem. In that respect, because he doesn't have any weaknesses of a kind, you know, and his powers are even more open-ended. Like, Surfer can kind of, like, on low levels, like, create life, manipulate reality. I mean, it's sort of, so usually it's more about, like, Silver Surfer is dogged by being a potentially bad person. So that's where our stakes are. But if you create a little character in there that is a little squishy thing that can get smashed or whatever, then, you know, now we have stakes. But so let's talk about because we've talked about so many elements of it, which is good. We should do that. But let's talk about the story, because we read 1 through 5, and like I said, a little piece of another comic, which was, again, all new Marvel Now 0.1. It had a little different. It was like a vignette or whatever. But anyway, so this is, I think, structured like a lot of volume ones of longer stories. We begin with a kind of 3-issue arc. Three-issue story, right? The kind of a precipitating event, and sort of establishes what kind of story this is, introduces all the character. And then we have a smaller story that follows up. And most of the rest of the story will be those sort of smaller stories. And it's a bit like X-Files in that it has a larger kind of story that it's engaged with, kind of like, and it's so interesting about how Dawn fits into the Surfer's fate and destiny and the universe itself. But either way, so we have that. And then we have these little episodic adventures where they go to different little planets and interact with, you know, bizarre sort of creatures or something like that.
Yeah.
The first story, like I said, and I always talk about precipitating events in stories because I'm fascinated with them. Because why is anything happening? Why do we begin now? You know, the idea of stories is, I mean, yeah, they might be slice of life a little bit. Like, we might all of a sudden just be, okay, what is it like? But generally speaking, shit has to start. So, like, things were going in a normal way, and normal was disrupted by this shit that happened. In this case, there is some wacky thing where Superman comes into the story, leaves so quickly, he's never in it at almost. Anyway, so the Silver Surfer is sort of just flying along, and a character whose name that I love, and let's face it, has Mike Allred written all over him. And that he was written by Mike Allred. Incredulous Zed, who we're going to find out has some pretty fucked up and mysterious motivations, captures or kidnaps Silver Surfer to be his champion against some great destructive force. But in order to get Silver Surfer, who has got his own agenda of just going across the spaceways, being stoic, and probably getting high. Let's face it, he's also getting high. Yeah. He has to be, right? doing space mushrooms or whatever. Or I guess mushrooms or space mushrooms. Anyway, so to get him to play ball, they have a machine that kidnaps, determines who your most important person is to you, and kidnaps them and threatens their life if you don't, you know, fight for their cause. And the twist, of course, is that Silver Surfer's person that they pick, and he's like, is it Shala Ball? Is it Alicia Masters? Is it Nova? And it's like, no, it's this person you've never met before. Her name's Dawn.
Yeah.
And that's how we begin. You know.
So it's I think it's on purpose to maybe like point you back towards Mike Allred's previous works, but I just want to point out, like, in the beginning, that there are these two Cambots that are the ones that approach Norrin, that are very similar to those little flying spheres that that would help document Madman's efforts and things like that. And also the car that Incredulous said, or the vessel that he rides around in, is this, like, it's almost like this old 50s Elvis Presley kind of just long hot rod sort of a spaceship, which is very similar to the thing that they travel through time with in that Madman story that we read. I don't think Mike Allred's lazy. I don't think that he only has, like, these certain designs in his head. I think it's I would have to assume that this is more just like, hey, you guys remember that thing I did? If you like this, I've been, you know, you would like it here too.
Yeah, and I think also it's just, I mean, a thing that he often does is this is the silly aspects of it where, you know, there's a kind of joke to it. There's an irony where it's like the kinds of things that we would expect to be in space, those sorts of tropes, he rebels against and does, like, you know, a flying car. Or he makes things profoundly terrestrial in this, but, like, you know, basically this Impericon, this city is sort of like a vacation planet. You know, so, I mean, some of this is just, like, just being silly. And because he does, you know, you did comedy or whatever, like, because it's, like, you know, comedians get good at telling similar kinds of jokes. So you're going to see some, like, repetition in their things or whatever.
But to the point of the story, I really like, or one of the things that kind of checked a box for me right out of the gate as I was reading it, was the fact that, like, he was like, oh, I don't know that person. Either way, I revere all life, you know? And that was actually kind of evident when he was walking through and being shown, this planet where they're like, yeah, you can ski on these leaves. And he's like, that must hurt the flora. He's like, actually, no, this is how we propagate the pollen. And, you know, like his concern for just the preservation of life and, I guess, you know, the life and the freedom of possibilities and things like that. He's like, all right, fine. I mean, like he was mad because he was already going to help. That was the other part, was like, he was like, no, I already said I would help you, assholes. Like, you don't need to endanger someone. But, like, that did increase the stakes, and you find out it's just because he had a hand in snuffing out so much life across the galaxy beforehand, now he wants to preserve it.
It was sort of always there, but what makes this, I think, a more full-bodied kind of characterization is that, like, it puts in connection and conversation more directly that, you know, Norrin isn't just such a great guy and he doesn't just have a generally noble reverence for all life. He also has it because of his previous history of being, you know, basically a genocidal
albatross, you know, essentially.
Exactly. So, I think that it's just more to the fore, more pronounced, sort of a better written version of that. And I think that there's something really lovely about when Silver Surfer and Dawn meet, because there's a sense where it's like, I was going to save you anyway, but then he starts to kind of fall in love with her.
Yeah.
And her, him. So they have a very generally noble kind of attitude towards, like, you know, he says something about, like, they're trying to get to that we're going to talk about it, but the Queen of Never's Heart. And she's like, well, I got to save these people. And he says, like, they're not important right now. And she's like, all people are important. And it very much, it's sort of like having somebody outvalue his values.
Yeah,
and vice
versa,
where she was like, oh, he was like, oh, I was going to save you just because you're a person. And she's like, oh, and it's just, it's gorgeous. And they find each other beautiful and everything like that. But to, I guess, to get to our story a little bit more, or like kind of get into it. So the idea, and I want to give you some background as well. The idea is this giant city, this, it's like Coruscant, like city planet of the Empyrean, is headed by a character I mentioned, Incredulous Zed. And the way, and we find that this place is not just, you know, big and crazy. It's also like the impossible is possible in this world. Everything, you know, the angles of the buildings are fantastic and bizarre, and everybody can have their own heaven and all that kind of stuff. And we find out the reason is because with this reality edge, this mystical or crazy blade from another planet, Incredulous Zed has gone to a character or concept character, I guess, the Queen of Nevers, or the lady. What is it? I always, is that right? Queen of Nevers?
I thought it was the Queen.
I think they call her also, yeah, Queen of Nevers, yes. I think they call her the Never Queen sometimes or whatever. But anyway, has cut out her heart and used that heart as the engine of this thing. And, you know, the reason Zed, you know, abducted the surfer is to use him to fight her because she wants her heart back. Now, I want to talk to you a little bit about Marvel abstracts. DC has done this a little bit. Marvel made it sort of just characteristic of their cosmos. So you do have, like, the in the Marvel larger cosmology, you have the gods, like, you know, the Norse gods and the Greek gods. And you also have, like, the Phoenix Force and all this kind of stuff. And you have Galactus, these sort of big on the anthropomorphic aspect of gods. But sort of above them, in a way, are more abstract deities. Now, again, they do get personified. They're literally in the shape of people most of the time.
Yeah.
But they are these avatars of, they're closer to sort of like the Endless from Sandman. So, you know, you have these cosmic deities of love and hate, Lord Hate and Master Love or something, Mistress Love and Master Hate, I think. Anyway, sorry, you have Chaos and Order, you have Lady Death, you have Oblivion, but for a lot of Marvel's cosmology, the largest sort of like most sort of chief deities in the Marvel universe itself were Eternity, who is like embodies all of space, and his other feminine side, Infinity, who is all of time. It isn't clear why they have those names or whatever, or what their relationships are, but they would, anytime you wanted to like exemplify all of the universe, you would point to this character, Eternity. Now, and so I'll give you an example. When in the Infinity Gauntlet story, when Thanos got the Infinity Gauntlet, he was going to essentially replace Eternity as the primary avatar of all being. That's sort of the idea.
Okay.
But this character is a play on that character. She describes herself as the Eternity's paramour. If you don't have it, it's kind of a kind of anachronistic or antiquated word. A paramour is sort of like a lover, but like a kind of like illicit lover, like a, you know, like almost like a liaison or something like that. So
sure.
So she describes herself as that, and she is the embodiment of all things that never were or all possibility. Now, this to me is relatively sophisticated from a philosophical place. That's why when I was reading this, I was like, this is not just somebody invoking big sounding concepts. The history of especially Western philosophy, especially Western metaphysics, is there, I mean, many things to say, obviously, but like there's a central insight, and you get it as early as Aristotle, which is this paradox that if you imagine all that is, you imagine being or something like that, we like to imagine, well, it must be all of the things are in the world. That's what it is. But the problem with that is that in order to change, in order to be new things, you have to have possibility. You have to have potential. But potential isn't what is, and it's not what isn't exactly. And that's crazy, right? Because what that suggests is everything has something that it isn't, but what it could be, which means that there is the, which is in a way that potential that never was or whatever, or whatever, she's the queen of possibilities or something like that. At the heart of being is also not being, which is a really weird fucking thing. And the idea that it's so central to this comic book and so fronted. And like I said, I think coherent, like this isn't just like a not like she, they didn't just get some like, I don't know, philosophy for dummies and look at one of the bold words. This seems like an intelligent, weird exploration of that, especially because so much of this comic book is going to concern itself with what might happen, some possibility and things like free will and destiny. I was deeply impressed with it, I got to say.
I was very surprised that they limited that story to 3 issues. Because, like, mm-hmm. I remember, like, when it wrapped up and all of a sudden we're back on Earth and, like, Cape Cod or whatever, I was like, I could have done that. I could have done that for another couple of issues. You know, right. I could have sat in that concept.
Well, you'll really love this because we're going to do it again.
Okay, good. I'm sure. I felt like the landing on Earth was a departure from really what the tone of everything was meant to be. And again, like, Mike Allred can't help but explore the cosmos in his storytelling. So it's like, even if you're stuck on Earth, there's going to be a billion aliens dropping down on you all the time. It's just going to be raining fucking aliens. So
that's true. And in this, so they do, in 3 issues, resolve at least the immediate kind of story, which is that they do stop the Incredulous Zed. They return the Never Queen's heart, and things sort of go back to normal. The crisis, universal crisis, averted, but of course, you know, you're going to have like all those same villains. It's more their introduction. So we have a mysterious benefactor of Incredulous Zed, who is sort of the emperor. We don't see his face. He's literally behind a hood. And then Zed is still somewhere. He's been excised from all of the universe, but he's somewhere else.
Yeah, like a cancerous tumor. I really like that. And yeah. I will say that, like, although I said I can't believe they jammed this into 3 issues, they did everything they could to explore the concept, like you said, of possibility and, you know, like the infinite potential of existence. And like that, I really liked, she found this heart. She found, like, she offhandedly, they just ran past the fuel source for the Impericon. And when Norrin was like, all right, we need to get this and take it to the lady, it turns into the little monkey with the symbols, the little toy.
Right.
And he's like, yeah, so your terrestrial mind can't really like conceive of what this truly is. So you're holding what your brain can process it as.
Right.
You actually see that monkey later. Like, that monkey is in her bedroom. And it also represents like her heartbeat, which I was like, okay, so the monkey thing felt kind of weird until it like started banging its cymbals slower and slower and like increasing the stakes. And I was like, this is fucking great, dude.
It's really smart. And all this first adventure is really, really cool because we get to see what both the creators here are really good at, which is, like I said, all those layers. And just to focus on Mike Allred because it's more visual for a second, we get both the more sort of, again, you know, every day, the quotidian, the sort of like just being what it's like to be a person in however like poetically conceived, like just that. And then we get the big abstract, you know, cosmically pondering kind of thing. And then because we go into the Impericon or whatever, we get a panoply of wacky looking, you know, aliens. So we get sort of all of those beats, which are all going to be, are going to populate the rest of this story. All at once, really smart. And then, and you can go back if you want to, but I wanted to just sort of play off of one of the things you said.
They go
back to Dawn's world, because at first we don't know that like they're going to span the spaceways together so Dawn can adventure and, you know, find herself. At first we just think like he was saving her, like he said he would, because he's her champion, and he's returning her to Earth. And so I think you needed to do that. One, I love it because I think it follows from the story. It would make sense that, if initially he would be taking her home. And also, it's kind of telling us, this is Dawn's story too. Like, she's not going to be just a well-written side character. This is very much about who she is and what she wants and where she wants to be going and, that self-discovery. Yeah. She's as dynamic a character as Silver Surfer is, which is really interesting. And again, it underscores the point that this really is also her book.
Yeah. And so the only thing I was going to do to just backtrack a little bit before that was to point out that, the humor in this experience that they're both going through is no matter how high the stakes are. I mean, and I think it's sort of typical Allred to have really high stakes in the A plot, but the B plot be really what you're in there for, which is this, this relationship blooming. The fact that all of these leverage people, the champion is chosen and this person is put in a holding cell as leverage for them to defeat the Queen of Nevers. The fact that those cells have universal translators attached to them is a Doctor Who thing, but also completely ridiculous.
It's also an everything thing.
Well, yeah, but completely pointless in a prison environment. Why would you want everybody communicating?
Right.
If you're gonna keep them all in individual cells, why would you want them able to collaborate some sort of opportunity to escape? That leads to her being able to execute her own escape, which is refreshing, not very anti Mary Sue. Mr. Migdala, that joke about it, just like, hey, just because I look like a fucking brain, everybody thinks I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Was like, that's good. And then the moment where they are heading back to Earth and he's kind of explaining what's going on, he's like, all right, I'm gonna take you home. And then he looks around and she's holding her breath and he's like, what are you doing? And she's like, we're in space. I can't. He's like, no, you can breathe. Why am I not cold? Because power cosmic. The power cosmic is very much the way, the TARDIS the Phi in sci-fi, it's more Phi than Psi in Doctor Who. So at any point, the Doctor will just be like, because I said so, or because the TARDIS does that. And they're able to gloss over this sort of thing. And for him to just hit the power cosmic is just like, hey, just fucking don't worry. I got you. The power cosmic has you.
And it works too for the Silver Surfer because from an editorial standpoint or a meta standpoint, the Silver Surfer is in many ways the kind of vantage point of the Marvel Universe. He's kind of the core of it. It's hard to say. Now it's a little different. You have the Guardians of the Galaxy who end up being that, and you have a bunch of Earthbound characters that have relationships to different stars spanning empires, like the Shi'ar, the Skrull, or the Kree, or whatever. But for a long time, he kind of was the core of that, and his power is, it's almost like Schopenhauerian will. It's the energy that is the underlying, being of the universe itself. It's that thing that the physicists are always going for, which is a formula, a kind of, what's it called again? A grand
string
unification.
Theory?
That would be an example of one. Yeah, grand unifying theory.
Sure.
His energy is sort of the grand unifying thing or whatever. So it's sort of nice that he occupies a place, and it goes to that point about he can bring life together or back from nothing. He can transmute matter. He can, radiate energy and all this kind of stuff.
Well, and that's a really good narrative device up top, because then it goes ahead and trims off a lot of the fat of dialogue and exposition that maybe would happen later. Every new companion in Doctor Who is it's bigger on the inside when they walk in it's this running trope of, oh my god. But when you can get your mind around that, then there's a lot less questions you need to ask moving forward. It's like, I'm a magic spaceman.
I think that's true that good sci-fi, good fantasy of all stripes has ways of elegantly misdirecting us from being overly concerned with the details or causes or, seeming irrationality of what's going on or whatever.
Yeah. But I, okay, so like to get back to the story, as they're on the way back to Earth, I actually wanted to ask you about a point in this, because I read a lot of Guardians of the Galaxies, but up to maybe 2013, you know, 2012. They encounter the Guardians as they come back into like the Milky Way, or you know, our galaxy. And is that Flash Thompson as Venom? The only person I didn't recognize is that Venom is a part of the Guardians now. And
he was for a period of time, maybe like 12 issues or something like that.
Okay. And that's Agent Venom, right? That's Flash Thompson.
That's right.
That's
cool. There's a period of time. So the Guardians of the Galaxy start in a kind of follow-up to Annihilation. In Annihilation Conquest, the sort of the Guardians of the Galaxy we know. So the original ones were like in the future or whatever. Great. Awesome comics of the 80s or whatever. But like, so these Guardians sort of start with like, you know, Star-Lord, Gamora, Drax, stuff like that. But they're changed again post the movie.
Yeah,
so
for the now
Guardians. Yeah. Exactly. So that Guardians of the Galaxy from Annihilation Conquest that puts that crew together of like, again, Drax, Gamora, Groot, Rocket Raccoon, Star-Lord, that sort of changes what the Guardians of the Galaxy are in the Marvel Universe, what the very word sort of associates. That itself, in and of itself, launches the movie or creates the story that gave them an idea like, oh, we could make this movie. And then that movie itself sort of turns around and changes, like I said, for the Marvel Now thing.
Right.
So it's, I only say this, it's way too much detail to just say that, like, after that happens, it evolves a little bit, and you still have a core team, but every once in a while, so like Iron Man was on it for a while. We see Captain Marvel here, Angela, and Agent Venom was another example of that, which kind of makes sense because, like, we can kind of forget Venom is an alien.
So it kind of makes it. Well, they point that out too. They're like, hey, we're just like searching for microbes. He's like, said the guy wearing a symbiote suit, you know, like who is literally carrying a space parasite on him.
Yes. And what's well, a symbiote technically. I mean, I guess parasite is a kind of symbiosis, but
it can be a symbiotic parasite, I think.
It's like a square rectangle relationship. But anyway, so what you're talking about in that story is they're flying back to Earth because he's returning Dawn to her home, and in the larger story about especially their relationship and some characterization that's like that sort of evolution, it's really great. It's like one character is a secret, we know the secret, you know, that's sort of the heart of drama in many ways. And so she doesn't know his past as, you know, I am become death, the destroyer of worlds,
right?
And anybody that knows about the Surfer is at least aware of that his past that way, and so many people all across the universe still associate him as that. So she sort of is sort of like, why does everybody keep referring to you as like Mangala or something?
See, that's a beautiful thing that I didn't think about until you just said it. Like, it's very, it's a very interesting way to start this relationship, is that, so she wished upon a star when she was a child, and really where this connection began was that she wished for that star to continue going. That star was Silver Surfer coming here to destroy Earth, which is beautiful. You know, when you really think about it, like, I mean, like, it's touched on a little bit by the Queen of Nevers, where, you know, it's like a wish is a really powerful thing and yada, yada, yada. And I gotta say, like, I'm gonna keep reading because I think it'll be more, but I was like, I hope this isn't really based around a wish or whatever, but fine, you know.
Well, it's really, I won't give it away, but I will tell you, it's way more intentional, and there's more going on to that moment than it even appears now.
Sure, sure, sure. But, like, this child wishing nothing but positivity and goodwill towards a herald of destruction landing on Earth. And then they touch on it later when he finally does get there, and all the people are a little blasé about him existing there and everything. They're just like, yeah, we just don't give a shit about too much superhero stuff, right? I mean, like, a bad guy shows up, good guys fix it, and then, you know, everything goes back to normal. Which really lends itself to the idea of, like, yeah, she had no idea what that shooting star could have meant for the planet,
right?
You know,
and well, it's pretty. So I also, this is a good moment to sort of mention the Silver Surfer's general reputation. This is one of those choices every writer gets to make when they write Silver Surfer, because there is no consensus and it seems to change quite a bit. So one is, who's even aware of the existence of the Silver Surfer? Two is, how long was he Galactus's herald? So what do people generally think of him? Do they more associate him as a noble sort of guardians of the, or what do you call it, like Green Lantern-esque, like universal space cop kind something. Of figure, or yeah. something like that? Or is he still, you know, by and large, like to the open public of the universe, you know, instant death? I mean, that changes a little bit. What's interesting here is how the Guardians of the Galaxy sort of, what they do when they come in, they kind of use this sort of like sensory device, and they tell them that it's to see if they have any space parasites on them or whatever. But after Silver Surfer and Dawn go to Earth and the Guardians are talking amongst themselves, they're like, they were just seeing if he still had an energy signature from Galactus, because they aren't sure if he's who he's working for. And that's true too. There wasn't just that immediate rebellion. There's been a few other comic runs where Silver Surfer has gone back into Galactus's service.
Okay.
Some writers, it's like Spider-Man going back to high school. Some writers just think that's where Silver Surfer is most interesting, and so sometimes in his history they kind of try to, that's happened from time to time, even in Annihilation or whatever. But I like that in this world the general public has very uneasy feelings about the Surfer, because he's sort of, even if away from the idea that he's oscillated back and forth, if you forget that history, just the idea, it's like, he came to destroy the world, but he didn't, he helped us not. So a lot of people are like, yeah, but he's, it's like if somebody like was going to blow up the White House and they're like, nah, I'm not going to do it. It's like, he didn't, he saved us. It's like, did you? Cause it kind of,
anyway, him over for dinner. Yeah, yeah.
Right. So I do like that he's like one of those characters like Adam Warlock, when the Avengers or the X-Men or whomever else, Fantastic Four. Well, the Fantastic Four do love the Silver Surfer. They do have a connection or whatever. But outside of that, when they're around these sort of cosmic characters, the good guys, they're still like, we don't really know what the fuck you're up to. You might have been seduced by a magical supernova, and now you're going to eat our ocean or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, you like, I mean, like an extraterrestrial sort of Punisher. Like, the Punisher always kind of is met
yeah.
with this unease, depending on
yeah, yeah.
the altruism of the character
yeah, yeah.
that he encounters.
Yeah, but, yeah. But and so last thing I guess we can say in story wise is when they go back down, there's a story with Nightmare. It's really good. I mean, we can talk about it a little bit, but we're just getting more. We're getting to know Dawn's family a little bit more. And on its face, the idea is that like they go down and immediately, as it happens, are greeted by. They even comment like, "Oh, the planets are weirdly aligned." Well, oh, turns out it's
all...
Nightmare is this dream demon who. Weirdly, isn't even really a bad guy. He's accidentally fucking everything up by taking a nap.
Yeah.
He's not supposed to sleep. It's a really weird choice.
It's not
what I will
of
say,
like Greek mythology sort of thing, like the way Loki yeah. used to kind of be handled. You know,
right.
like it's like, hey, just...
That's Norse mythology, but yeah. I'm
sorry, worried. Sorry. Yeah, yeah, like, yeah, I mean, just like, not necessarily nefarious or bad. It just, he just, if he fucks up, then
but
everything's
this
ruined,
is a bit of
know?
A...
Like, if, he,
this
if
is
he's
a,
not minding his P's and Q's.
Right, but this is a bit of a departure because, like, this would be in, like, the 5% of the time kind of thing. Nightmare is about as jokerish, chaotic, evil as you usually get in comics.
Like, normally?
So,
okay.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Like, you, I mean, he's a, it's something about the construction of his face, too. It's like, he's just smiling too evil.
Yeah.
But also, something noteworthy here is, like, the idea is there, Surfer doesn't know that he's asleep, everybody's having these nightmares, but Doctor Strange and Hulk are, appear, and they kind of know what's going on, and they want to help a little bit. Let me explain. So, are you familiar with the Defenders?
No. I'm totally like I.
Oh, okay.
None of this story throws me off. I was just taking a deep sigh because I love the way All Red draws the Hulk.
I
love this old Kirby. Just
it's a it
not
fits
this
well, yeah.
giant thing, but like still very yeah. big. And like this is at
right.
a time when the Hulk is verbal and cognizant. You know, like that kind
yep.
of goes back and forth depending on, you know, who's writing and whatever.
Yeah.
But
true.
I love this just sort of bigger kind of gorilla kind of Hulk.
Yeah. But I just wanted to comment that like they're there if you don't have a, if you're for the listener, the Defenders now was a word that they've applied to the Netflix series that was the street level heroes like Daredevil, which is, I don't care, but it has confused. Like, the Defenders was a kind of like B-level franchise that took basically the loners of the Marvel Universe and put them on a team. And rather than like the Avengers that was like, we're all separate heroes, but hey, we kind of get along and we're, you know, it's sort of Justice League with our powers combined. In this case, it was like, what if like the Hulk, Silver Surfer, Namor, and Doctor Strange had to work together and basically hated each other the entire time? Like, they're just like, yeah, you're a fucking dick, man. I don't like you. Okay, I know we have to stop like Pluto or whatever, but we're never going to drink together. You're a dick. Anyway, yeah. I think what this does in the broader sense, and what I do like about it, it's very similar to Swamp Thing, Alan Moore's, but in other Swamp Thing runs where, even Ram V's recently, where they're sort of reminding you, hey, this is off the beaten path, and this is weird, but this is still in the Marvel Universe, and here are some other characters.
A good team up is always going to help you. Keep it going a little. A little razzle dazzle. Yeah. It's like, hey, the second I saw them on the cover, I was like, fuck, yes, because I was mad that they were leaving space. Cool. Yeah, I want to see Strange. I want to see Allred draw Strange and write this character because he is just as weird and metaphysical as Allred already wants. Allred already wants to be.
He's working on Excellent right now. Excellent. It's a sequel.
Oh, that was real. I couldn't tell if that was you pulling something out of your ass.
It's real. It's Excellent. Yeah, it's like a sequel to Ecstatics. And Doctor Strange is actually in it a lot, so we get to see he's even better at drawing Strange than he ever was. And we mentioned before, but also like not to be forgotten, that they meet the Guardians of the Galaxy, a contemporary at that time Guardians of the Galaxy. Galaxy, which is also just telling us like, hey, remember, this is still in the Marvel Universe. That can be a hard thing to manage, but when it's done well, I think it just brings a lot more. There's something that really works for me about these stories when they're still happening in the now of comics. Like it increases the stakes and feels more current for me. So that was kind of our story.
They wrap it up real neat and tight. They give everybody the story itself, especially at the end, gives a really great opportunity to explain more about the people in Dawn's life, which I think is really cool. But like in a real fast, quick way, you know, we're not like dwelling. We don't want her to feel bad, you know, like we actually want her to feel like she can leave at the end, which is exactly the way this shoots out. They ride off into the sunset of the universe, and it's exactly how every Doctor Who Capay is like, hey, do you want to come with me and just see everything? And she's like, I don't know. Yeah. And then they just go, and it's so good. And so there's so much energy to that, that it's like, oh man, everything coming after this is going to be really fun and probably episodic. It's going to, you know, he's going to land on a planet made of animal mushrooms or whatever the fuck.
For anybody else reading from the trade, New Dawn, Volume 1, there's one last little issue I don't think you read.
I didn't get to, so if you want
to
talk about it.
And just to touch on it just very briefly is that it's sort of what you're talking about. He literally, the first thing they do is literally he takes her to a place to kind of impress her. I mean, it's so funny because it's not the most explicit in the text, but you can, if you just sort of like think of it like, okay, this is sort of like a guy's, like, it's a new relationship. He takes her to this place with, like, manta rays that are, like, flying, like, it's like they're cosmic rays. And then she finds out, oh, they're, like, rays, okay. And in the meantime, he gets into a fight with these assholes who are, like, pirates. And it's more of that building that tension of, like, why is everybody afraid of you? You're such a nice dude. And that's kind of the little sort of thing. It makes sense as this promotional comic that was in this other comic, because it gives you a good sense of like, okay, this is the basic like dynamic that's happening in the comic right now.
I'm going to buy all these issues and grind them up and fucking mainline them.
Like, you can buy the omnibus.
What are we talking?
That's
volume one, right? What is that?
Yeah, exactly. So this is 1-5 plus a little bit extra. So almost like 5.5, but like I said, it's only 29 issues. So you can sort of imagine that it's five of these little volumes or that omnibus. That omnibus is actually, because it's not 29 issues, is not that great in size. Sorry. It's
right.
It's wonderful. But, that it's the omnibus is actually pretty manageable. But let's do some final thoughts, and then we'll do recommendations, and we'll get out.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what are your final thoughts? You didn't know about this, and you aren't a big Silver Surfer guy, but you love Mike Allred. So what was your takeaway here?
Yeah, no, I honestly think Mike Allred could sell me on anything. This is literally the only other, like, outside of the Man-Man properties and the spinoff things, this is the first time I've seen Allred do a character that is more, you know, that is not specifically owned by him and is more widely known character in general.
Mm-hmm.
And perfect. I can't necessarily assume that this would work, that Allred is the perfect person to put in charge of any title, honestly. But whatever kismet brought him to this, and him and Slott got a real good symbiosis in the way that they can write together.
Definitely.
When I was saying that I could pick out Allred from the writing, that wasn't because it was so starkly different from everything. It was just like, I think I'm just so well versed in his kind of silly, nonsensical cuteness that, and like my experience with Dan Slott doesn't have that vibe. You know, there's nothing really about Superior Spider-Man or, you know, probably other things that I've read that like invite that kind of whimsical shit into it. So it's like,
I think both are true, because like, even if it's the case that like this is, because I agree, it's his sense of humor specifically that feels very specific to Mike Allred. I also think Dan Slott is familiar with and probably a fan of Mike Allred, and his writing was probably writing a little bit more in that style anyway. You know what I mean? Like, even if they weren't going to be the specific lines. Well, what I think, just since we're on the topic, one of the things that he said, that, like, Allred was like, he would give them the scripts and the breakdown and a heavy encouragement to just like do your thing with it. So I think a lot of it is like they're collaborative. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, everything lined up so well. I was so excited page to page, just because there is something very human about Norrin that I wouldn't have expected. Like, he's not as detached as other cameo appearances would lead you to believe. And, you know, this is a good time to shake things up with this Marvel Now thing going on. This is a good time to like reintroduce everyone to this character. And it does such a really good job. I'm sold on it. I'm definitely going to get that omnibus. I'm going to kiss it and hide it under my pillow and just take it in by osmosis. So yeah, perfect landing. I would give this a 10 out of 10. I hope Mike Allred feels my love coming, just radiating out.
But well said. So yeah, I think this is one of my favorite comic series of all time. One of my favorite Silver Surfer comic series of all time, if not my most favorite. I think that the thing I'll say about this is that it reminds me of so much of Alan Moore's Swamp Thing in this very specific way, which is, even though this is technically a pre-established IP and part of a serialized ongoing story in some sense, this feels more like a independent story like you'd expect from like Brian K. Vaughan, like Saga or Preacher or something like that. This is a little shorter than that, but it has the hallmarks of really well constructed long form, you know, that kind of, even though this is a 29 issue thing as opposed to those which are usually like kind of 60 issues around there, this still, like I said, feels like it has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And I think I mentioned before, there are characters like Thor or Silver Surfer that are, like I said, lush with sort of thematic potential. What I love about this story is, despite all of the tropes and trappings of superhero comics, this has themes. It's about something. It's one of the greatest weaknesses in a lot of superhero comics. I have a tendency to think it's the editor's fault. Like, I mean, I just think that they are the explanatory feature, and the editors being communicating the kind of business end of things, as well as a number of other things. But it's not really expected that superhero comics be about anything, that their stories have themes, or at least not ones that are I think, at the fore or what have you. And it's to their weakness. There's not a reason that, like, almost every other form of fiction You know, I mean, I shouldn't. There's plenty of like silly soap opera serialized stuff. The point is that this has everything that's great about superhero comics. Plus, it explores topics of like fate and probability and free will and love and finding yourself in finding your opposite. All these wonderful things. Does a really good job. I couldn't imagine a better comic, especially for what this is. God, don't you love Dan Slott? Don't you love Mike Allred?
Just yes, so great. So much.
Yep.
So much.
Let's do some recommendations and we'll get out of here. You got anything or you want me to go?
I'm just gonna my recommendation is watch Doctor Who. If you're gonna I generally try to always come up with a comic to recommend. There are a lot of really good Doctor Who comics. That is sort of the value of it, is there's a lot of really good audiobooks. This is one of those things, this is one of those properties that is exquisite across all media. And there's like media being found all the time because of the way the BBC like kept up with their like old footage and stuff like that. So I would say for anybody who is completely blank in experience from Doctor Who, I would say jump into Dave Tennant or Matt Smith, like I did, because the production value is enough to keep you in there. But I think like if you jump in there, you get endeared enough to the character and the concept that, like I did, you want to start all the way at the beginning. And you have 70 years almost of material. And
so just get started now. And you know,
I was putting it off till retirement and just accidentally fucked around and watched Matt Smith. And you should just hop over and check out a little bit of Doctor Who.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't know almost anything about Doctor Who. I think what is a good sign from looking without is that it seems like one of the few unique sort of franchises or what have you. Like, you know, there are so many things you see and it's like they're basically doing Lord of the Rings, they're basically doing Star Wars or Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Whereas the Whovian community, it seems like it's like Avatar. Not that it's like Avatar, it's just like it's its own world. It doesn't really, I mean, I know Avatar is heavily derivative, I just mean like it does feel independent, right, and not immediately connected to like,
I thought you meant Airbender for a second. I was just gonna let it pass by
that too. But anyway, okay, so I'll be excited to check out Doctor Who. I hopefully I won't wait till retirement, because it definitely is something I need to have. If only just to you can send me stuff and maybe put it in the description as well of like,
yeah,
where you would start. Like, just remind me, because anyway, so my recommendation, I got two. I mean, there's a lot that I could say. There's a lot of really good Silver Surfer stuff out there specifically. One, so it's kind of coherent with the show that we've been doing. I've mentioned this before. I would check out Silver Surfer Black. It was written recently by Donny Cates. But it's similar to this in the art. I mean, it's Trad Moore is the same guy that did the Ghost Rider story that we looked at. And it's just another interesting, again, sort of psychedelic, out of this world take on the Silver Surfer's world. So it just purely for the art, I think check that out. The story's good too. It was sort of like the lead up to, or the second lead up to Null, who was a character Donny Cates sort of brought into life, whatever. But then the other thing I want to recommend is Silver Surfer Epic Collection Parable. Very specifically this. The Marvel Epic collections are really good, you know, huge chunks of storytelling around a character. Oftentimes it's just a long run that a character might have, like maybe they'll do one for all the stuff that led up to the Kraven's last hunt or something like that, or maybe John Byrne's Fantastic Four. In this case, what I like about this edition is that it has several different watershed moments in around the same time, but of Silver Surfer comics, mostly around the 80s and 90s. It's got art writers like Steve Englehart and Mark Gruenwald. These guys really sort of developed, along with people like Jim Starlin, the Marvel Universe. Marvel Cosmic Universe specifically. It's got some great stories. It's got the one that has the Inbetweener and versus Galactus. It's really wonderful stuff. And it also has a great story where Silver Surfer is in a sort of like fight with or in between Galactus and Mephisto.
And that was done by Stan Lee and John Buscema. So it's like these two guys in sort of the sort of twilight of their career who, and it's an amazing, it got, it's beautiful. If you don't know John Buscema, I mean, his, he's one of the, like, he's right after Kirby, right after Steve Ditko, it, just in terms of like when he kind of takes over the look of the Marvel universe, but it's just such beautiful stuff. And specifically, it has the art of Ron Lim. Ron Lim still does stuff now. But his heyday for me was his work on Silver Surfer and, you know, Infinity Gauntlet and the Thanos Quest and stuff like that. He really, in my head, is what Silver Surfer looks like. And it's just beautiful work. I think he does a fantastic job. Check out that. I really think you'll like it, especially if you want to get to know like the heart of Silver Surfer kind of cosmology and mythos.
Hell yeah.
We did it.
We did it.
We did this comic. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so much. Have a good day.
Recommendations and, We will be back soon.
Oh, we forgot to mention the whole funny Toomey thing. Oh, just real quick, Toomey. Yeah. Toomey, my board. So cute.
Yeah. Did you just Toomey me?
There's a very minor one where she also thinks he's being called Harold.
Comic, comic, comic canon revival.